and printed in Wikipedia material talking about neutrons is inappropriate. Dr. Ray.
Reading and talking is fine in my book. It's where you get practical and start to play the mad scientist. You know, one of the synthesized elements, polonium, played a big political thing with the Russians, poisoned some poor guy. Apparently, they had some umbrella tip that had a small, teeny tiny pellet of polonium, and they spiked them with it. And a couple of weeks later, he basically melted in a hotel room and caused other people to have secondary radiation problems as well. So, I mean, talking about it, I'm fine with. Please, people, don't go to eBay or the dark web and try and get some radioactive material to play with.
Yes, I agree. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's time to change the subject. I agree. Talking and reading is different, unless I should say this is a quote from Wikipedia, and that's what it says, and end of quote. But kind of sensitive. So let's go to diamonds. Oh, before go to diamonds, I don't know if we have a time. To go to diamonds is 2:22:11. Maybe we go to the red shift, Doppler effect, blue shift. Dr. Roy.
Well, I have 10:14, so your clock is slow. So I don't know if you... I don't think we'd be able to really cover much in a minute or two, so maybe you want to table it for next Sunday night?
2-2-R-1.
Okay. Well, the red-blue shift, I believe, is quick. It's just astrology and what that means, and eventually how is that attached to the Doppler effect in the space subject with you.
Okay. David wanted to say something. What did you want to say, David?
QSO, good evening. I remember looking for some kind of way to see if there was any specific radiation in my house. So I looked on eBay, and there were many devices, I guess they called them Geiger counters, made in the former Soviet Union. Very interesting. And the other thing I wanted to say is earlier this week it was announced that the United States Department of Justice is suing Apple for iPhone monopoly. Go ahead.
I believe we have a few minutes left and I don't want to waste it, so I just finish that subject.
Okay, David, I'm sorry, but you kind of came at the tail end of my little thing that I do. Maybe you want to come back next Sunday and we can discuss these things?
Sure. If it's not that, we can discuss something else.
Okay, very good. So let's quickly go back. Wesley has a question about redshift that kind of goes into the topic of Doppler shift, astronomical, I think he said astrological, but astronomical Doppler shift basically has to do with three aspects, the simple relative velocities, the time dilation of fast objects in the special theory of relativity has a component of Doppler shift and time dilation and gravity has an effect on Doppler shift. So three components to astronomical Doppler shift. The simple one of velocity is the faster something is running away from you, the higher its velocity, the more its wavelength of its emitted electromagnetic waves are redshifted or kind of stretched. If it was running towards you, it would be blue shifted and short length, shorter frequency, and that would mean that it was coming towards you. But most everything outside there is going away from us, and that's because of the great expansion of the universe. It's inflating. It's getting bigger and bigger as time goes on. What else did you want to discuss about redshifting?
Yeah, as the universe expands, astronomers use redshift and blueshift to deduce how far the object is away, and actually that led to scientists to discover universe expansion. It's not old. I believe that was 2010, when that 2012, when universe expansion was announced. And of course, we don't want to go to acceleration because that, as you wrote in email, that is too much of explanation. But a few words about the universe expansion and how do they measure that? Because normally you would say, okay, I'm looking at the star, and then 1 year years later I can come back and measure if the star moved away or moved closer to me. But we don't have that 1 million years, so the scientists decided that they have solar bodies, and by position of the solar body they find out that the universe is expanding. So a few words about it.
AC2GS. Well, just a few words because I really want to give Paul his time. Expansion of the universe is an old thing. Edwin Hubble himself described it in 1929. Now, at that time, we still had, at that point, we already had the Big Bang Theory. So the idea of a kind of steady state universe really appealed to people, despite the fact that the universe was expanding. So the best suggestion people had was that it's expanding, but there's so much gravity in the universe that it's slowing down, and it'll eventually stop, and then it'll reverse its course, and everything will be attracted gravitationally until it reaches the big crunch. And then after the big crunch, there'll be a big bang, and then there'll be a big crunch, and then there'll be a big bang, and on, forever and ever, and probably before us. Unfortunately, over the years since 1929, they were able to assess the speed at which things are flying away from us, and over decades they were able to measure that, in fact, it's not slowing, it's speeding up. So the big problem is not that the universe is expanding, since we knew that since 1929, but it's increasingly expanding. And then the problem is, what the hell is the force that's accelerating the expansion of the universe? And that's when we had to deal with things like dark energy.
Yes, the only question I have is about the time it was discovered. It was 2014 when astronomers found that signal detected could be explained as which signal, which was electromagnetic wave, as the proof of universe expanding, and they use special technique. So maybe the phenomenon was known before, but the actual technique was developed not long time ago, which actually proved that the previous thesis or theory, how do you call it, corrected.
Okay, I think you got your years a little wrong. I think what you're alluding to is 1998, when they realized that the rate of expansion is increasing. And I believe they discerned this using a distant supernova, which you know, they discovered that they could use as a means for telling these slight variations and such. So it was 1998. It wasn't in the 21st century. It was back in the good old 20th century.
Oh, okay. I was reading about it, but not to the very depth of it. So yes, there was a technique instead of observing one object and waiting long time and then measuring that object, you could use the solar bodies, and then you have a supernovas that can all around that could explode once a month, let's say, and you could observe them and then see their movement or their motion, and by that you can see the direction that they are going and see the expansion.
I see, too, yes. The first thing where you mentioned that you measure and you wait a long time and you measure again is parallax. What you're doing is you're measuring the angle when we're in one side of our orbit, and then you're measuring the angle from the other side of our orbit, and you're measuring the parallax error, and that's good for determining the distance of nearby solar objects. You couldn't kind of do that with far-out galaxies because they're just so far out that our measuring equipment would not be able to discern the parallax error of those far-distant points. That's when we discovered supernova of a certain type have, when they explode, they give off a rather consistent amount of light. And if you measure their light intensity, you can figure out their distance by the inverse square law. And so that was a better way of predicting the distance of objects that are too far away for parallax. And knowing the distance and then finding the redshift, you could then discern velocities and where it's going and speeds and such. And so that's what was going on. So it kind of annoyed everyone, again, because back in the earlier days, the Big Bang and the Big Crunch were very symmetrical. Nowadays, we're stuck with this open-ended universe that ultimately will die in a trillion years in the great heat death. But that's a story for another night, I guess.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Question. Do we have a few minutes to go to Diamond, so we skip it and put it on another night?
Well, again, we're already 10 minutes late for Paul, so I think we should kind of put it in the hamper, and we can take it out next week. You know, diamonds won't go away.
Okay, thank you very much. Natasha.
You're welcome. Thank you, Wes. Thank you, everyone. And I agree with you, Jeff. There's a way. Well, there was doubling, and we have to kind of remind everyone, and I know I'm probably guilty of it as well, although nowadays, because of my All-Star link, I can actually hear anyone doubling with me and stop immediately. So thankfully, I'm never the problem, but still, we have to remember not to quick key, and we have to remember that when there's more than one person talking most of the time, you should kind of stop and see if you have the repeater. So I thank you, Jeff, for reminding me to remind everyone of simple politeness and proper behavior. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a few things. And I hope you come back next Sunday when we try and do it again. But now it is time for the SpaceNet Report with WS2N Paul.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Yeah, good topics. Wesley had good topics as well with the mass and all of that. I don't know, I just go by the atomic number. He was converting it to weight. That's interesting. As well as the topic before that, the beryllium topic. NASA. Well, Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA, you know, the James Webb Space Telescope that they put out there, that 21-foot diameter mirror that they used, made of 18 sections, all the support behind it, all the brackets, are all made of beryllium, you know, that whole frame, because they wanted something with a low coefficient of heat. You know, when you heat it, they want to make sure that thing didn't expand or contract, you know, in deep space with the changes of temperature. Wanted to keep the mirrors exactly perfect. So they used beryllium. But, you know, you're right. They had a very, very careful, you know, with the technicians that cut that stuff up and put it together. They don't want to inhale that. Okay, let me drop it off. I'll go through a couple of these topics that I have. This is WS2N. Okay, last Saturday, today's Sunday, no, it would be Saturday, they actually launched Tracy Dyson, astronaut from the United States. They got her to launch on a Soyuz rocket with two other crewmates. They were supposed to go up Thursday, and they wound up going up Saturday early in the morning. I got to see it when it's a launch from Kazakhstan. As long as you have a NASA astronaut involved, NASA TV puts it on. So I got to see that launch, which is very good. By the way, she's a ham, KF5DBF. So you have now another ham heading to the International Space Station with the other two crew members, the commander, because the Soyuz rocket is, of course, Russian, Oleg Novinsky, and Tracy also had another female astronaut going up with her, Marina Vasilinsky, and she's from Belarus, of all places. First person from Belarus to go into space. And they're on their way to the International Space Station. As we speak, tomorrow, around 11 o'clock or so, they will dock. They were supposed to take 3 hours to get there, a little over 3 hours, if they had gone up on Thursday. But they did have a scrub. Very unusual for a Russian Soyuz vehicle to be scrubbed, but they have a low voltage reading coming from the first booster. So they waited a couple of days. They changed out battery packs and made sure everything was okay. And sure enough, they successfully went up yesterday morning. So we'll wish them well. They'll be joining seven other people that are on the space station. And now there'll be 10 temporarily. What happens is some of the ones that are up there will be coming back very shortly. In fact, the crew that just went up now, two of the people, the commander and the lady from Belarus, they'll be coming back in 12 days, so they have a short visit, and they're going to be bringing another American back. She's been up there for 6 months, O'Hara, so she'll be returning with them. But they're going to be leaving behind Tracy Dyson. Like I said, she's got a ham pool for another 6 months, and then they'll be back to seven on the space station temporarily. So those numbers always fluctuate. Every time you have a new crew going up to stay for a while, you always have somebody returning shortly after, usually a couple of weeks later. But the constant number is always seven. So that works out just great. And the reason for that is you have four from the American side, which when a Dragon goes up, it's four people. And you have three for the Soviet side. So you always have a constant, at least seven people on board. Okay, I know I timed out, but any comments? Like I said, you always have at least seven people on board the International Space Station.
Comments?
Okay, comment. Go ahead.
Hey, keep it feeling. Can we keep calling them Soviets? I love that.
Can we keep calling them Soviets? Well, if he collects any more countries, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what he's got in mind.
Yeah. Just a comment. You said Soviet instead of Russian, but I think that's just people of our vintage.
Oh, did I? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, of course. I don't like to do that. Yeah. Well, yeah, to be, that was the name for decades and decades. And, you know, and it's weird that they have that, well, Putin's got that goal in mind to bring all those countries back together again. He would love to have his Soviet country back together again. That ain't going to happen. All right, we'll continue on here with, I want to talk about this, the DART program that went up a couple of years ago. Yeah, the DART mission was the one that went up and smashed into the asteroid. DART was the one that stood for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. And the idea was to hit the smaller asteroid. There was one smaller one orbiting the larger one, and to see if it would change the timing of the one smaller one going around the large one. And they have used different methods to figure out if that did occur. So, you know, that did happen, I think, September of 22. And now they're able to figure out the results. And it used to be a couple of hours to make one orbit, a little over. I wrote down the time here somewhere. It was 11 hours. Yeah, 11 hours and 55 minutes. And now the time has shrunk by roughly a half hour because of what we did. But, you know, that just proves that it worked. So they realized that the orbit changed. And by slowing it down, because, you know, they hit it head on in the direction that it was going, by slowing it down, the orbit actually changed. Well, it used to be circular, and now it's slightly elliptical. So that definitely changed. Also, the shape of the asteroid changed. It used to be like more like a sphere, and now it's more like an obloid sphere from hitting this thing, which tells them that the asteroid really wasn't just one big solid rock. It was really a collection of rubble of, you know, a million little pieces put together. And it was able to actually change the shape of it. But it was successful. The idea is to see if you could not only change the orbit going around, but by doing that, you're actually changing the orbit of both of them that goes around the sun. And, of course, the idea of that is if you could do this on a regular basis, if you have an asteroid that's coming in that's possibly going to hit Earth, you could actually change the orbit of that asteroid, especially if it's a double system like this, to miss the Earth, which I think is great. I always worry about, you know, some bizarre country deciding, well, let's, you know, they're in a hurry to meet their maker. Let's change the orbit to have the thing hit the Earth. You know? But you know, fool around with stuff like this, you possibly could get burned. But anyway, it did work, and the results are out. And then I believe another year from now, they're going to have a launch. The European Space Agency is going to have a launch to go back to these asteroids. The idea is to take some pictures and get up real close and check out the damage. They're going to send that information back, not only to the European Space Agency, but, you know, we're involved with them. They'll also make sure that we get the information. Scientists will have a ball with this stuff. Any comments? Put it at this ball, WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. You know, NASA always has plans into the future. You know, what's going to happen not only, you know, a year or two from now, but 5 years or maybe even 10 years from now. And they start these things sometimes 10, 20 years you know, before anything ever happened. That's what happened with for instance, all these different rovers that went to Mars. We sent in 1996, you had the Pathfinder landed on Mars. A rover came out called Sojourner. You know, they planned years before that to do that. Same thing with Spirit and Opportunity when they went to Mars. You know, again, years and years of planning, and sure enough, you know, it happens. Then they talked about MSL, they called it Mars Science Laboratory, and eventually got a name called Curiosity. And I remember talking about that 10, 15 years before it was ever launched. And I'm saying, boy, I hope I live long enough to see that. Sure enough, that Curiosity has landed very successfully on Mars, as well as one that landed after that called Perseverance. Perseverance also brought up with it a helicopter, and they named that Ingenuity, and that flew for 72 flights on Mars. They were hoping to get 5 out of it, and they just kept doing one right after the other, and that, you know, for a couple of years. Very successful. They proved that they could fly something on Mars. Well, now NASA has plans. You know, they devoted some money to it. It's going to be a long way off. But the idea is to put an airplane on that planet. And they call this thing Maggie. Stands for Mars Aerial and Ground Global Intelligent Explorer. This thing is a nice, good-sized airplane. Maybe with a wingspan of looks like about 25 feet or so. And it's got electric engines. It's got actually two sets of wings, and both sets have electric motors. It's all going to be solar panels. The whole top of this thing has all solar panels on it. Maggie's going to have the first wing set up as 8. The other one has a little less than that anyway. It's got a total of 14 electric engines that will propel this thing through the Martian atmosphere. Now, it's not easy to fly anything on Mars. It's less than 0.1% of the atmosphere that we have. Sure, it has less gravity. It's a little less than 1/3 the amount of gravity that we have, but still very thin atmosphere. They say it's equivalent to flying something at 100,000 feet on Earth. So when they designed helicopter Ingenuity, they made it with these 4-foot-long blades that are spinning hundreds of revolutions that a helicopter might spin on Earth. They designed it to spin over 2,000 RPMs, and they made it adjustable, too. They could send a program to the helicopter on how fast the blades could spin. And sure enough, it worked. Over and over, they said 5 times, it lasted 72 times. So now, based on that, they figure, well, let's send an airplane there. Now, how are they going to get an airplane to Mars? Plan on launching it on the Space Launch System, one of the rockets that they're planning on eventually colonizing the moon or setting up a base on the moon. Same launch system that they used a little over a year ago to send Orion in orbit around the moon and then return safely back to Earth and land in the Pacific Ocean. Of course, without a crew on it, the next time they do it, they plan on doing the same thing, except with a crew. Well, the Space Launch System, they also plan on using for other things, in this case, to launch this airplane to Mars. They'll put it into a capsule similar to what they did for the Perseverance rover and the Curiosity rover. So, you know, you'll launch the Space Launch System, which has the 4 RS-25 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines. It has the 2 gigantic boosters on port side, starboard side, similar to what the shuttle had. Those things will separate. The core will continue on with the RS-25 engines. Core will separate, and then another stage will ignite. That stage will have 4 more engines. They call them RL-10 engines, built by Crocodile. So you're going to take that stage will push the payload all the way to head to Mars. Payload itself will separate from that final stage. You'll just have the cruise stage, and that's very similar to what they did with the last two rovers. It should take about 6 to 8 months to get to Mars. Come flying through the atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour with a heat shield, and this thing's enclosed in this vent module. Heat shield will have that does its work and plus come through the atmosphere. Parachute will open up, start to slow down even more. The heat shield will separate from the bottom, and then that will expose this airplane thing inside this capsule. That whole setup also has it, like a fluid pack on top, jetpack system. The airplane drops out of the descent module, starts heading down to the planet. It'll have 8 thrusters on board, which will start to slow it down, and it'll get very close to the surface, similar to what they did with the rovers. And before it gets, before it gets to the surface, it'll have these cables that will start to drop it out of this jetpack system that's flying above it. Cables will lower the airplane down to the surface. After the plane touches the surface, the cables will be cut with pyrotechnics, and the upper stage-like jetpack thing will eventually fly away. And that's a similar setup to what they've done with the other two landers. But they know how to do that. Now, this airplane is sitting on the surface of Mars. Next step, of course, would be to put all the engines on, all the electric motors. They'll, of course, do that after it's completely charged, and things should be able to take off. They can fly around 3,000 feet, they said. Not high. No higher than that. And on one flight, they're talking about almost 100 miles. If they want to. So they'll be able to go to different areas and come down and land. This is a vertical takeoff, vertical landing vehicle. The wings don't change, but the flaps in the back go all the way down so that the air goes, well, you'd have to see the video. The air flows straight back, and then the air starts down, straight down, follows the curve of the wing. And that gives it lift, and that's how they take off and land. You know, when they're in flight, elevated, they change back on the wings. So that's pretty cool. Can't imagine how many years it's going to be before they get this thing off the ground. But they call it Maggie, and I put a picture of it on Dr. Roy's website. So if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, you'd be able to see what this contraption looks like. It's pretty interesting. Any comments? WS2N.
Kilo, Echo, 2, Alpha, Juliet, Uniform. Paul, this is Charlie. I just got power back, so I'm on the radio now.
Very good, Charlie. Welcome back. Power problems? Warm? Are they working in your area? What happened?
I don't know. About an hour ago, about 9:50, the power went out, and I missed your show. I started writing things down because I wanted to ask you questions.
Okay. Well, if you could think of a question, yes, sure. That's what we're here for. What part of Florida are you in? I forgot.
Engine. They had four. They used it four times. Okay? How much wear and tear are they going to get out of that one engine?
I doubled with you right in the beginning. I was asking what part of Florida are you in? I believe you're in Florida. But something that they use four times. What's the question again?
Okay, the Vulcan 9 engines, they used them four times already, okay? How much more can they use these things? I mean, they turn engine around in less than a week. They had a SpaceX sent the rocket up on 314, and then they did it on 322 with the same engine.
Yeah, Falcon 9 engines. And they'll be doing it with their new rocket, too. They'll be doing it with the Raptor engines on the Starship. That's their goal. But, yeah, the Falcon 9, the turnaround time has gotten shorter and shorter on some of these rockets. And, it used to be months, and, that's short. A couple of these boosters have gone up. One of them has gone up 19 times so far. Others, 15 or 18 or 13 times. You have 9 engines on each booster. They come back down and land, and because they're made so strong. Nibibium, I think, is what they use. Steel is its alloy, incredibly strong, and that's what your combustion stages are made out of. And the pumps, these impeller type pumps that spin 20, 30, 40,000 RPMs, that pump all the fuel into the combustion chambers. You would think that they would give out, but they use the same ones. I guess if they see if there's a problem, they probably will change it out. And they're able to change it out pretty quickly. The way they have it arranged, you have one in the center, and then you have 8 that are surrounded on the circumference of the rocket. So they have it laid out horizontally on this big roller. They could roll it, open up section by section, inspect it, or if need be, change out the engine. So the initial flights when they started making these things, SpaceX said, they were hoping for 5 flights, but they said we're going to extend that, hopefully up to as many as 10 flights before we have to refurbish it, and then keep refurbishing it up to 100 flights. So they haven't gotten up to 100 yet. Per booster, but they have launched a lot of rockets. They are now over 300 successful launches with the Falcon 9 rocket. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, but these Falcon rockets—they're turning them around in a week. In a week, they're taking off. They come back down, and they'll be ready to fire for Easter week.
Yeah, I think they had a record of, 5 days or something with one of them. And, of course, they go fast if they bring them back to land. Two places they really land. They either land on the autonomous drone ship, 400 or 500, sometimes 600 miles out to sea. That takes a long time, a day or two before they can get them back to shore. Back to the boosters also come back and land at landing zone 1, landing zone 2. But what SpaceX did is they took over one of the launch complex 13, that wasn't used anymore. They put 2 gigantic concrete pads down right near one another, and they can land those things right back there. So when they do that, of course, it's back in Cape Canaveral. They bring it back to their, another name I call it, the hangar, but they bring it back to their building, put it on a lean, get it ready for the next flight. Yeah, that's what they've been doing. And they plan on doing the same thing with Starship engines. When they start going up, each booster has 33 engines. You know, interesting thing about the other one, the Falcon 9, is when they send up the Falcon Heavy, that's three boosters at one time. They kind of like bolt together. So it's like launching three Falcon 9s at the same time, 27 engines. And the center engine, and on those flights, they do away with them, the drivers. You know, they let that one just, you know, go into the drink. But the other two, they always come back, and they land those, not on the drone ships, they land them back at Cape Canaveral, at Landing Zone 1 and Landing Zone 2, where they took over that Launch Complex 13. So that's always pretty cool to watch. When two of them come back at the exact same time, they come right down close to land. You see the four legs open up, one engine firing in the middle. Very successful. They haven't even crashed one of those. They used to crash the ones in the beginning on the drone ships. You know, I think they had four or five launches that were not successful when they were learning how to do this. Back to you, Charlie. WS doing.
I was watching on the video that the Japanese had two launch pads, and they were taking this one rocket, they were testing it, and it kept going back and forth to each landing zone. I says, this is a rocket they're talking about. This is not a little handheld droid.
Who's doing this? The Japanese? They're working on this now? I haven't seen that one. I know China is doing it, but they haven't been successful yet. They're working on it. They're doing ground testing. They'll set up a small rocket. Well, it's like you said, a good-sized rocket. It's not as big as what SpaceX has, but they'll send up a rocket. Why, you know, 500 meters in the air, bring it over around 30, 40 feet, bring it down and land. I've seen that. They got a long way to go. I mean, SpaceX is way ahead of them. But we have other companies that are going to be doing the same thing very shortly. Probably within maybe 8 months or so, you're going to see the new Glenn Rock rocket lift off from Cape Canaveral, Launch Complex 36, built by Blue Origin, which is really Jeff Bezos. Of course, we know him from Amazon, but he also owns Blue Origin. And they're going to be launching those rockets, the new Glenn rocket, which is larger rocket than Falcon 9. It's closer to the Saturn V rocket size. And then you have another one being built probably a year or so after that by another company called Relativity. And they're going to be doing the same thing with medium lift rockets.
That time, complete.
Heavy lift rockets. And they'll be coming back to the launching pad as well. So they're all getting in on the action. They have to. You have to stay competitive. It's a lot cheaper to refly these rockets than it is to send them off and, you know, to Davy Jones's locker. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah. And to see 19 launches from one Falcon 9 engine. When we were kids, the NASA would send something up in the air, and then that would be it. It'd be lost. It'd be found in the ocean somewhere. But today, I can't believe they're reusing them and reusing them. I think the metal they're using is a titanium. Okay? It's one, stronger than steel, and lighter than aluminum.
Oh, there's some titanium parts, but the outer part of Falcon 9 rocket is an aluminum alloy that they're using. When you look at the Starship, they sent three of them up. They plan on launching a fourth one probably within a couple of more months. Of course, they haven't made it to orbit yet, but they're trying. But that rocket, that one, which is bigger than the Saturn V rocket, the body of that, you're looking at stainless steel, and that was their choice. So that's what they're into. Some of the other ones have carbon-based. Electron rocket being built by Peter Beck's the owner of Rocket Lab. He builds the Electron rocket. That's a carbon 3D printed. It's a carbon based material, carbon epoxy, and he flies out of two locations, one in New Zealand. And the other one, in fact, I was going to talk about it tonight. The Electron rocket flew out of Wallops Island, Virginia. Rocket Lab built a launch complex there, and they just launched a satellite for the NRO, National Reconnaissance Orbiter, or National Reconnaissance Office. They sent the satellite into orbit using the Electron rocket, and. Yeah, a lot going on. We're having a heck of a time trying to keep up with this, Charlie. Back to you.
Yeah, I was looking at all the companies here that are into the space stuff, and Elon Musk, he seems to be the biggest.
Yeah, he is, but he's gonna have competition soon with Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin. And eventually, Relativity will be there. Actually, Rocket Lab, like you said, launches the composite rocket, the Electron. They're also building a heavy lift vehicle called the Neutron rocket, and that will also be launched out of Virginia as well, Wallops Island. So he's going to have a lot of competition. Of course, foreign countries are getting involved, China and the European Space Agency. I just want to mention, you're calling it the Vulcan rocket. The Vulcan rocket is the one that is built by the United Launch Alliance. United Launch Alliance is two companies, it's Boeing and Lockheed. They became United Launch Alliance. They launched the Atlas V rocket. Well, they just recently launched the Vulcan rocket. The Vulcan rocket was the first one of that group that they've developed. So that's going to be very competitive as well. And that's got two engines that are built by Blue Origin. They bought the engines from Blue Origin. And those engines are called the BE-4 engines, so they're built by Blue Origin. So you got the Vulcan rocket built by United Launch Alliance. You got the Falcon 9 that's built by SpaceX. Okay, Charlie, back to you.
SpaceX has 13,000 employees. That's a lot of people. I worked for Grumman back in the day. That was like the biggest employer on Long Island.
Yeah, it certainly was. Yeah, I got to work near or in the Grumman facilities because I'd worked for an outside contractor, and we got to do some piping in the Grumman facilities, which was great. You know, because I got to see what some of the stuff that was going on, but. 13,000. About a month ago, I was quoting that they had 12,000. So, maybe you read that they now have 13,000. So, maybe they're getting more people involved. Blue Origin has upped their numbers as well. I think they're into the 11,000 category now, working on their rockets. So, a lot of people involved. And look at all the spin-off businesses that are created, that are connected to this industry. It's unbelievable. When you were working for Grumman, they used to quote the number of 400,000 people were involved in getting people to the moon. Do you remember that, Charlie?
Yes, I do remember. That's even though it's a little before my time, but yes, I remember how many they had in Grumman.
Very cool. Did you work in Bethpage, or were you out in Calverton? I wound up in both places.
I was in both. I was there from 86 to 91.
Very good. Yeah, I was in and out. You know, we'd go in for, you know, a couple of weeks and then maybe a month, you know, whatever it took to do whatever installations we were doing. But, you know, I got to see a mock-up of the LEM. Now, this is, you know, way after, probably in the 1980s. They had out in the field behind one of the hangars that was just sitting there. No ropes around it, no nothing, just this mock-up, just gigantic, you know, LEM sitting back there. Very cool. Okay, I'm looking at the time. I, you know, getting to the wishing hour, so I'm going to start to shut down, and we'll turn it back to Roy. Before I do that, we'll be back on the air tomorrow night, usually Monday night, with the club InfoNet by Limock, followed by the Flop and Chop, and then followed by Newsline. So now we'll turn it over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for all that you do for the SpaceNet report, all that you do for the technical net, all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. John dropped off. Okay. I was going to tell him that I have on the link page a new entry. Lou, NY2H, in the chat room, left us a site for a web page called Maximum Power Transfer Theorem. It has some mathematics in it, but it will hopefully help people understand the idea that matching impedance of source and load gives you the maximum amount of power transfer under some circumstances. Anyway, thanks to everyone. Our rebels now are done. Remember what Dick K2RIW would say at the end of each and every one of his technical nets: be kind to each other. That's always good advice. Also, remember good old Epictetus. It is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep an open mind and learn something new every day. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. So use your brain. Anyway, have a great week. Be well. Stay safe. And come back next Sunday when we try this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after my closing comment, which has it's been kind of a regular one. Slava Ukraine.
Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. Hey, Paul, I'll speak to you in 2 weeks. I won't be here next week. Have a nice time. Bye.
Very good, Charlie. Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. Have a good night.
YouTube.
Hi, Roy. You still have a minute. WB2BXL here.
Sure, Frank. Anytime. I was hoping we could do Great Circles today, but it seems to be cursed. Maybe we'll try and do it next Sunday.
Oh, okay. That ought to be fun. Hopefully, you'll be able to get on next Sunday. That is interesting. I don't know if you watch, kind of at a bad time, Dr. Tamanaka Scott did a live informal solar forecast and propagation forecast at like 11 o'clock last night. Wants to watch something serious like a radio propagation forecast at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. But anyway, she did show the charts of the Great Circle paths and how there was poor propagation over the poles this week because of a geomagnetic disturbance. Very interesting and very well done. She's doing more ham-related propagation forecasting now, I think, now that she's actually got an amateur license. Go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, I missed it, although I took up the solar weather this morning for the 10-meter net and noticed the geomagnetic storms. Propagation wasn't really great. People came kind of in and then out. There was real fluctuations for a bit of a half hour or so. We had a nice opening to Texas. I must have contacted five Texas stations, and then just like someone flicked a switch, they were gone. So, got a couple of other states. Didn't get outside of, didn't get past Texas, didn't go on the West Coast or anything like that, but it was okay.
Yeah, I know one of my buddy of mine on the West Coast alerted me that T32EU in the Eastern Kiribati Islands, I guess it's actually the Republic of the Eastern Kiribati now, I think it used to be the Eastern Carolines, was on 10-meter sideband. It was actually kind of weak on the East Coast. I have that one confirmed on 10 meters, so I wasn't that worried about it. I called them once or twice and didn't get through, and okay, I have other things to do. I have this one confirmed already. So, yeah, I agree. Propagation wasn't that great, and that's essentially what Dr. Tamitha said, is that because of the solar flares, a combination of solar flares, not one large solar flare, as she expected the propagation to be a bit disturbed for the next couple of days. She agrees with our observations. I think I mentioned it last week that propagation is, Ted Cook mentioned it in his solar prediction a couple of weeks ago, I think, that propagation is not really what you would expect it to be for this point in a good sunspot cycle. So we're not sure if this just isn't going to be a really good cycle, or we're just not at the peak yet. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, everyone says, well, whenever we discuss this, you don't know you've reached the peak until you've left it. So who knows? Maybe it's going to be biphasic. Maybe it's going to be triphasic. Yeah, I mean, the whole summer was a mystery to me. Something was knocking things out of whack. I wasn't getting outside of the local area, and you would pull up the solar flares, and they were shooting up there. But apparently, it was a combination of solar activity that helped and hindered simultaneously. So you just have to hope for the best. We really don't have much of a clue of how the sun works. You know, we have some insight, but the details are missing, and you know, people are modeling things and making predictions, and who knows how it all ends. We'll see when we drop off of the final peak, if there's more than one, what the heck this was. And we're kind of only going to know it from the back end, not the front.
Yeah, we've had a couple of biphasic peaks the last couple of cycles. The 1968 cycle had a second peak in 1972. The last one had a second peak around 2014 or 2015. I just got licensed in time for the second peak of, I guess it was cycle 19 in 1972. The first peak was in 1968, while I was still very young. Then for the last peak, I had just gotten back on toward the tail end of it, and it wasn't a super good peak anyway. Anyway, it's interesting. There was some six-meter propagation today, late in the afternoon. I decoded on FTA to station in Ecuador, but he had a huge number of stations calling him. And I saw spotted a station in Galapagos. It was essentially north-south propagation. I don't think anything from Europe was coming through. But anyway, so it's possible that FLA propagation got up to 6 meters, but it's always kind of speculative whether what you're hearing on 6 meters is FLA or East Gip. Go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't looked at 6 meters in a while. My antenna really isn't designed for it, but, you know, receivers are very forgiving. You know, I wouldn't try transmitting on my 10-meter antenna for 6 meters. But I haven't asked.